The magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
SiriusXM Sports presents... At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. It's about 5 minutes into hour two, and we're just a day late. Getting to Arno Delacour. I apologize. Arno, congratulations on the grade one.
Thank you very much.
How was the drive yesterday?
Uneventful.
Well, that's how you like them.
Exactly.
Right? It's funny because we talked about Chez Pierre, there was obvious anticipation about what you had here, and boy, oh boy. Everybody tuned into the race expecting, here's another big visit to the U.S. by Modern Games. And he was forgotten about in a rank hurry. This was some performance.
I agree. He did very well. And I guess the key was that he was really relaxed as opposed to his previous start when he came back at Tampa. And after the layoff, he was just a little edgy, a little aggressive. You could tell that he probably was going to need the race. But he was so good, and his body language before the race was so good that I thought we would see the best of him, and we did.
Well, he is. It's interesting because he's a 5-year-old, and that was only his 7th start. So this is a late model car with very low mileage.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, he had a few setbacks. Lord, we've very been high regarded even in France. I mean, Francis Graffa had him and really liked the horse. Just a few setbacks after all there. And here we are, 5-year-old with a few races only. But very good.
That's an interesting point. When you get these horses, would you rather have a nearly, you got him, at the beginning of last year, so he was a 4-year-old, but would you rather have a mature horse, Arno, or do you prefer to have one that, that you pick up and start with as a 2-year-old?
It doesn't really matter. The only thing that's a little bit tricky with the Euro is when they come and they have almost no condition, you pretty much have to go stakes right away and face like a tough competition. So that's always tough. I mean, you like when they come and they broke their maiden and you still have like 2 or 3 conditions to play with and get them familiar with American racing. With him, we had one allowance and we had to go stakes right away. But good horses overcome that.
It remind us about last year and what prompted the... after April, after the Henry Clark win at Laurel, basically on the shelf for 8-9 months.
Yeah, he did something like he pulled a muscle in his back. Something that would be fine with time, but we had to give him like 4 months off pretty much. He came back very well, hasn't missed a beat since, but we were just bad timing, basically.
Well, now a grade one winner, but of course this is a gelding. So, I mean, other than just, picking spots and having fun with him and adding to the Jackson's trophy collection and yours, what kinds of things do you have in mind for him?
Well, first of all, it's a good position to be in because it's less pressure. You're not working on a stallion prospect. And I think that he's just very efficient at the mile. Mile on firm turf is probably a thing. So we're lucky to have a good program in the U.S. for those kind of horses. I would say, the top of my head, I'll do the Shoemaker mile. So that's late May in Santa Anita. maybe the Foster Dave, the Shadwell Mike, the Breeders' Cup. I mean, if that would be the schedule for him.
How now that you got him, obviously you got him back rolling. How active do you want to be?
I don't really want to rush him in races. I just want to make sure that the setup is fine, meaning, the right distance, the right ground, and that the horse is doing well. I mean, as we know, often enough, they, spike the temperature, do stuff like that. So as long as he's well, there's no ready timing. I was even thinking about running him at Gulfstream in the Canadian, but he spiked the temperature a few days before, so that was out of the question. So now, if he runs, 5-6 weeks, I'll be comfortable with anything. But if I have to wait on him a little bit, especially in the summer, it's not bad either. You have a fresh horse for the fall, which is major as well, especially when you run in the biggest events.
Is it more fun to give riding instructions in French to Flavien Prat than giving it to somebody that, doesn't speak French?
I don't know if it's more fun. I mean, Flavien is a one-tone type of Frenchman. So some Frenchmen would be more animated than he is. And he's just very, very low-key. So I wouldn't call it fun, but we understand each other, yes.
That's pretty well. This was, that's what was so fun about this. I mean, he's a French bred. He's named after the French restaurant up here on Route 9 in Saratoga, well, almost in Wilton. And then there's you and Lee and Flavien. So it is Vive la France all up and down the
exactly.
Too fun. Well, this was not only was the performance notable, but we're not going to get $20.84 again anytime soon.
No, I don't think so, we'll take it. We took advantage of that, so we were good.
Good for you. I love it. Well, a lot of people. I mean, he was. I'm sort of a. I'm somebody that, for whatever reason, modern games. I just kind of. I'm ambivalent. I look to beat him every time. And so you and Emmanuel maybe and that up to the mark. Marty McGee liked. I mean. I was surprised that he was that price.
No, I agree. There was a few horses in the race that, without production of beating Modern Game, that looked like would be, in a race like that, Modern Game is coming back. We're very happy to be second, right? I agree with you. It was a wide open race after Modern Games.
We should also note, this is your fourth grade one, and it comes with three different horses, which is awfully nice. Of course, last year in the Oaks or a couple of years ago in the Oaks with Magic Attitude, and I think people forget that you won grade ones on the dirt going short with AP Indian.
They sure do. Because I'm level as a turf trainer, we had a few nice wins on the dirt also. Even Divining Rod was very performant on the dirt, and a couple of horses like that. But yeah, it's always fun at that level. We really don't take it for granted, and it's wonderful to be able to win grade ones.
You mentioned Divining Rod, and of course, standing at Country Life. Had the Divining Rods come your way from the Jacksons?
Yeah, we had a few homebred and also horses that were bought. There were some nice horses, mainly local horses, Milan bred, that can make a living around here in the Mid-Atlantic, which is great because that's where we are.
Exactly. There's actually a three-year-old filly that's debuting Thursday at Charlestown.
I must have missed that.
McGeezer, the three-year-old coming up this week, just looking at the entries. Let's talk about what's going on elsewhere with you, because obviously, Arno, the winter Tampa, you got off to a very nice start, and you win a grade one like this at Keeneland. That you know, that also goes a long way. You ran Opus 42 in the Beaumont on Sunday. Maybe take a second and talk about her.
Well, I mean, I think we haven't quite figured out yet. She may want to go back to the turf, to be honest. We were taking a shot. She looks like she was doing very well at Tampa on the dirt at Tampa, which is really specific. So she liked that surface. The other day, she just got tired. I mean, mind, she was chasing a very strong, good horse. On a strong pace. So maybe that's why she got tired a little bit. But I think that she's less efficient on a dirt like Kinlan or elsewhere. So I'll probably try her back on the turf and find some good races for her in the summer here.
I should mention a couple of other recent stake runners. Candidate tried the Transylvania last weekend.
Yes, so it didn't break very well, and then after that he was like a little immature or a little aggressive in between horses and didn't really like that. So we're probably going to, you know, regroup with him. We actually gelded him shortly after the race and going to let him matter. I think he's a nice horse. He's still very immature. He's also a Mayfall, a big, good-looking horse, but they'll need to fill out a little bit. So I'm lucky to train for owner like Mr. Greer. I would give us plenty of time to let him develop, and I think we'll have a nice horse in the summer.
I want to ask you about a horse that may show up next time that she shows up. She's going to look a little dirtied up from that disaster in the Florida Oaks where she got whacked by the gate. I'm talking about Navy Goat, who had a look coming in, and did she get hurt out of that?
Yeah, she came back. She came back with a bit of an issue after the Oaks. Nothing that can be solved, but it was time to take care of her and give her a few months off. So she's right now in Ocala. We're going to take our time and hopefully come back and have a nice fit in the fall.
Oh, good. All right. She's an Army mule that we took a shine to, as a 2-year-old. How about some of the recent maiden winners? Arnaud Delacour with us on the heels of Shea Pierre's Grade One Maker's Mark win Friday at Keeneland. But you had Bazzano break the maiden at Laurel. You had Tuddenham Mill, about 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago at Tampa. Give us a couple of looks ahead for the maiden winners.
So Bassanio, I think is a nice horse. He a little bit backward. It took him some time to develop and to come to himself. But I was very happy with his performance. Obviously, he won. But not only he won, but he did it very professionally. We were adding blinkers, and that seemed to help a little bit. So I'll be looking forward to run him in Alormans condition in the Mid Atlantic. Should be very efficient, and if he keeps improving. Maybe why not a stakes like toward the end of the summer?
Well, that sounds good. How did your season go over the winter at Turfway? You had some run.
I was very happy with it. We didn't send like a lot of horses. Had about 10 horses there, and I think we won 5 races. But they all ran well. They were competitive, and I actually liked the track. The surface was wonderful. No horses got hurt, like in the morning or in the afternoon. I mean, it was really just very good. We kept them on schedule. So I was very happy with that, and hopefully we can do that on a bigger scale next year.
Very nice. All right, let me ask about one starter tomorrow. The second timer. This is the Into Mischief Filly After 8, which is a fabulous dinner mint. You're obviously running a theme, Arno, between Chez Pierre, the restaurant, and then After 8, those fabulous thin mints. You ever have those?
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, you got a sophisticated.
I've got one else that are quite foodies, so that's good.
Tell me about her. Is she ready tomorrow?
Yes, I really like her. She's always shown a lot. We ran her on the dirt last year, and I thought that she's going to show a lot of speed and be very performant. She didn't show as much speed as I was hoping for and came back like a little sore from a race. So we regrouped. We gave her plenty of time. She's coming back. I'm excited to run her on the turf. I think, you know, on the dam side, on the family, there's plenty of turf. So I'm very excited about that finish. She's one of those that breathes like light out in the morning all the time. I am not sure she'll draw in though. She's the 14
yeah.
on the A. But if not, we'll find her another spot. There might be something else that can run if it doesn't work out.
If she could enter back, she's into mischief. She was a $425,000 Keeneland yearling. Out of a dam that of Mrs. Schuford's that was winless, classy dame, and so on the female family side, they're got to go back a little bit to find some heft. Actually, quite a bit back. But if you like what you're seeing. I tell you, Mrs. Schuford kind of overbred this mare to a degree going into mischief, but it paid off because fetched real money.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, if you have a nice individual buy into mischief, you're in pretty good shape when you sell them.
Exactly.
But we like her. She's been very impressive in her workout. So I just need to find a spot. She might, you know, as every horses and young horses, she might need time or two to figure it out. But I think she's a nice finish.
You know, it's too bad. It actually, just looking at this field tomorrow, this is the eighth race. It's kind of too bad you didn't get into the body because this looks like a good spot.
Yes, no, I agree. I would obviously split the race.
Yeah.
I would have been happy in either division, but, Keeneland is obviously a very popular meet, and all those horses are ready, young horses. There was like 40 entries or 43. So,
wow.
You know, you need to be lucky a little bit. So.
Yeah. That means there were six excluded from each division. Holy cow.
That's right, which gives us a good hope to have another race before the end of the meet.
Right.
We'll see if they can do that. But so hopefully she gets to run tomorrow and we can have a good idea of where she fits. But I like her.
I love it. Well, I'm glad we looked into this. And after eight goes on everybody's watch list. And Arno, J. Pierre bursts on the scene. And wins a grade one. Well done to everybody involved. And we'll look forward to seeing you at Keeneland next week and Churchill and down the road.
Wonderful.
Arno Delacour, everybody. And just one of the really good low-key outfits that, between him and wife Lee. They originally started running in her name, and then she took some time to get the family going, and they started to run in Arno's name, and they just do a fabulous job. I mean, consistent win outfit, and I'm glad I brought up AP Indian because you could tell that he doesn't bristle at having a reputation as a turf trainer. But I mean, let's be fair, European trainers when they come here and South American, they've got this mantle kind of hung on them that turf trainer, that's not fair. It's they can make it happen with any kind of horse. Does a great job. All right, let's get John White, sending me a couple of I'm going to use that picture. All right, let me get John in here. He sent me a picture from, oh my God, 2005? Is that possible? Holy cow, John. John looks the same. So does Rachel, actually. It's a picture of John and Rachel from the early days at Indiana Downs. Well, let's get John in here, and he'll regale us with that story. That actually is about the era. It was about probably 2006. I'm gonna guess it was about 2006, maybe, or 7 at the latest. John will remember because he... Mike, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm tremendous. You know where I'm headed, where we met face-to-face. We had talked on the phone, obviously, but we got a chance to actually meet for the first time at a Summit of Speed that you were covering for HRTV. When do you think that was? 06?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. Boy, that's so far long ago. Like, all I remember, it was so hot.
Yep.
That Michelle Blanco, the publicity director there, came down to the paddock because I was wearing a suit and a tie. And it must have been 95 degrees and the humidity 99. And she came down and she said, you know, it's so hot here, John. You really don't have to wear the jacket. And I said, Michelle, I appreciate that. But if I take this jacket off, you're not going to like how it looks underneath. So we're just going to go forward with the jacket on. And she said, I appreciate that too.
That's pretty funny. That time of year, summer in Miami Gardens. It was hot. But that's where we met. It's got to be, it can't be 05, so it's got to be, it's either 06 or 07.
I'll tell you.
What horse?
It would be a musical romance one that day. So,
all right, there you go.
With Juan Leyva, who would become the regular exercise rider and the assistant trainer for Flightline, the assistant to John Sadler, and he rode musical romance to victory that day. And, in fact, Juan Leyva, when I was working as a safety steward at Los Alamitos, and this was the year that West Coast won the Traverse. So I guess that's how I live my life. I find the timelines with these winners of graded stakes races. But I actually proctored Juan Leyva's written test to become an assistant trainer to John Sadler.
Wow.
So. That was, and the people there at Los Alamitos, which at that time, I mean, it was during a quarter horse meet, and those people, I was trying to tell a lot of the officials there and everything, this guy was a very successful jockey and won a Breeders' Cup race. So, I mean, because these were quarter horse people, they really had no inkling of what Juan had accomplished in the saddle. And but that was one of my fond memories as a safety steward, was proctoring that written test, and he did extremely well on it too. And I'm not surprised to see Juan do well with John Sadler. And of course, he was a huge, huge component to that success of that horse, because if you go back and look on XBTV at Flightline, at his early works, he was basically a complete runoff. I mean, he would tug so hard and want to go right away in a workout, and they worked on him and worked on him and worked on him. And the difference of when he was headed toward that Breeders' Cup Classic, how he would relax so nicely at the start of a workout, it was night and day. It reminded me a lot of the work that Ross Fenstermaker did with the Great Precisionist back in the 1980s, because Precisionist, when he was a two-year-old, he was much that same way. I'll never forget his career debut with Terry Lipham in the saddle and at Hollywood Park. And I came home and told my wife, I think I saw the best two-year-old in the country today. Lipham won with, as they say, his feet in the dashboard. I mean, this horse wasn't even really asked, and he ran like 6 furlongs of 109 and change. And, of course, he would go on to have a Hall of Fame career. But the work that they put in with the Precisionist, because he was a very headstrong and very hyper 2-year-old. And it wasn't basically until he won the spot stakes by 10 lengths that he kind of turned the corner and blossomed into the real top horse that he became.
Well, and Juan Lave, of course, the go-to rider for Bill Kaplan on you know, most of Bill's horses, and she was terrific. You know, she was also a horse that went up to Presque Isle you know, during that run where Presque Isle and continues to be productive toward the filly and mare sprint, and you know, between her and who, Groupie Doll, and there were it was an Informed Decision, and it was crazy. They're one after another went up to in September to win the Presque Isle Masters, and then on to, you know, on to glory in the Breeders' Cup. Well, I'm just looking that if she won the Princess Rooney Jaunt that day in Summit of Speed, that actually was 2012, and that seems way later than I would have expected.
Well, it could be.
That could be. No, that could be. I mean, an HRTV was still around. I mean, that, right? That wasn't...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I guess that's what it was. How about that? July 7th, 2012.
Well, in fact, I was the first hire by HRTV. That was in 2002. That was very important because... it really filled a gap for me work-wise, in that working at Santa Anita in television, that meant I was out of work for like half the year. And when HRTV was started, that filled in that gap nicely. And it was great for me because HRTV being based at Santa Anita.
Yeah.
So I was the first on-air person hired. Peter Lurie was the second person. Randy Spiraghi was the third person, and for the first year, we were the only three on-air talent. Lafitte Pinkai III was originally hired as a producer, so he was one of the first producers hired there before he got involved in the on-air aspect. And I was originally on from 9 o'clock in the morning Pacific until 5 o'clock Pacific. By myself.
Oh, Jesus.
And I will tell you, I mean, and our tracks that we were able to cover in those early years of HRTV weren't exactly what you'd call necessarily the A-list. I mean, I covered a lot of Great Lakes Downs and Freehold with the harness and so forth. So, but I actually enjoyed a lot of it. Great Lakes Downs, I enjoyed covering them, and you know, but HRTV grew and grew and grew, and then eventually was bought out by TVG, which of course now was FanDuel TV. But I had a really good long run there with HRTV. A lot of people still come up to me and say they miss HRTV. And of course, a lot of our people, you know, Christina Blacker is a person that was a producer at HRTV before she went on air at TVG. So, you know, and I enjoyed the Magna 5. We used to do a big broadcast for the Magna 5. That was a lot of fun. And those were great days. There's no question about it. I mentioned Christina Blacker, and I happened to be in Vegas over the weekend, and I made a bet on the Milwaukee Bucks, only to watch the Greek Freak hurt his back in the first quarter, and there went my money right down the tubes on the Milwaukee Bucks. And a friend of mine was saying, boy, that's a pretty bad, you know, tough luck. And I said, yeah, it really sticks in my craw. But I said, it's far from my worst beat. And there's no question that my worst beat was with a horse called Dan Derrick that Christina Blacker's husband, Dan Blacker, trained. And Kurt Hoover and I, this goes back to HRTV, he and I were on the morning shift. And Hollywood Park had a double carryover in the pick six, which in those days in Southern California,
big deal.
If you had a double carryover, that was a huge pool. And I put in like a $144 ticket, and I had three horses in the first leg. And that first leg was run right before Kurt and I were getting off the set. And Dan Derrick was in front by like a length at the 16th pole, and he wasn't the favorite in the race. And I had a lot of long shots on that ticket. And Dan Derrick looked like he was headed for a certain victory. And all of a sudden, it looked weird. We couldn't figure out what was going on with the rider. I don't remember who was riding him offhand. But it was like, you know, he looked like some, you know, starting apprentice or something. And Kurt and I were looking at each other like, what the heck's going on? And he got beat, not by much. I don't remember whether it was a head, a neck, or nose, but it wasn't much. And I, you know, you're sitting there with a pick six ticket, you think, well, so much for that. But what I liked about the pick six was there was always the hope that you might get three consolations, since I had three horses in that race. And if you went on and got five, you'd get three consolations. And that kept me afloat. That's one thing I like about the Rainbow Six, is there's no consolation. So that's why I won't play the pick six except on the carryover, on the mandatory payout days. But so I go home, I get off my shift, I go home, I'm watching the rest of the races, and I had the next five winners.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of happy, and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to, you know, end up with three pretty nice consolations. So they were like $1,000 a piece. So that was like $3,000 for $144. And my producer called me from HRTV, Chris Speck, and he says, wow, that was quite a ticket you had at Hollywood Park. He says, do you know what happened in that first race? And I said, yeah, I got beat. And he says, no, what happened is that horse that ran second that you had, the rein broke.
Yep.
And I said, what? And he says, yeah, the rein broke. And it's in the actual chart of that. And so I called someone in Mutuals the next day at Hollywood Park, and I said, if I had won that pick six with that horse, Dan Derrick, what would you say that pick six was going to pay? I don't remember the exact figure he gave me, but it was well over $100,000.
Sure. That equipment, Jesus, equipment, that's equipment failure.
Kurt Hoover said that of all my years of watching gambling and sports and horse racing, that is the toughest beat I've ever seen. So, and I said, well, and I asked Christina if I could get that rein, you know, maybe a half of the rein or something. I would have liked to have got that, but I never did get that rein. I would have called it, you know, my $100,000 rein.
Unbelievable. That pretty funny. John, you also, on the HRTV front in coverage, you sent that picture. You listened to Rachel in the last half hour, and what a great picture of you and her going back to 2005.
Yeah, that was a fun trip, and I really enjoyed it. That's one of the 65 tracks around the world I've been to, and I was there on a HRTV assignment, and really enjoyed it. She was very nice, and Bill Downs was the track announcer there.
Sure.
At that time. I had known Bill from Santa Anita because he sat right next to me in the press box at Santa Anita for years when he was an aspiring announcer, and he was calling races into a tape recorder out on the roof. And so I got to know Bill real well at Santa Anita, so it was great to reconnect with him. Now he's at Emerald Downs, and a lot of those guys used to do those radio results, or the telephone results line at Santa Anita. That's what Bill was doing for Santa Anita at that time.
Oh, wow.
John Lees was another guy that was doing those the telephone results line, but going out on the roof and calling races. And of course, now he's a racing secretary. He's an announcer. He's Del Mar and Will Rogers. And he's also in my fantasy league. So, horse racing fantasy league. But, I did want to mention to you, since we've got the Californian coming up this week at Santa Anita, as we resume racing with what they're now calling the Hollywood meet, following the classic meet. So this is kind of the version of racing at Santa Anita that used to be held at Hollywood Park. And the Californian, of course, was one of the big races at Hollywood Park. And back in the 1960s, Steve, the Californian really was a huge deal. It was the race into the Hollywood Gold Cup. But the Californian on its own was big. And in its early years, it had conditions that I think it for the most part, it would take an MIT physicist to figure out what kind of weight a horse deserved to get in the race. And there were, it was so complicated that there were times where a horse would get assigned the wrong weight and they'd have to correct it. And one of those instances occurred in 1968 when Dr. Fager flew out from the East Coast to run in the Californian. And he flew out on a Friday, won the Californian on Saturday, and flew back to New York on Sunday. But the late Bob Benoit once told me a story, and then I was able to verify this because Bob Hebert of the Los Angeles Times also wrote for the Blood Horse, and in his recap of the 1968 Californian in the Blood Horse, confirmed everything that Bob Benoit had told me. And Benoit told me that the original weight given to Dr. Fager for that race was 124 pounds. And Bob Benoit was called to the racing office, and they told him, we've made a mistake, there's been a mistake made, and he's going to have to carry more weight. And Benoit said, well, what's he going to have to carry? And they said, 130. And he says, oh. And they said, we want you to call John Nayrud and tell him. And he goes, why do I have to call him? And they said, well, you're the publicity director here. And they said, so you call him. And Bob says, so I did. So he calls John Nayrud back east, and he says, hello, Mr. Nayrud, this is Bob Benoit, the publicity director at Hollywood Park. And Nayrud says, hello. And he says, what can I do for him? Benoit says, well, I've got some bad news for you. And when he said that, actually, Dr. Fager was on the plane at that time. And Nayrud was scared that something had happened on the plane, maybe. And he says, is the horse all right now? Oh, yeah, the horse is fine as far as I know. No, that's not why I'm calling. And he says, well, then why are you calling? And he says, well, Mr. Nayrud, there was a mistake in the weight that Dr. Fager has to carry. And Nayrud said, is that right? He says, well, how much does he have to carry? And Benoit says, 130. And there's this long pause. And finally, Nayrud goes, it won't matter. And he hangs up. and I'm figuring if Benoit had had to call Bobby Frankel and tell him that he had to carry 6 pounds more in the Californian, it wouldn't have been a calm, it won't matter. It would have been an explosion equal to Mount St. Helens in 1980 in Washington State. And the thing was that Nayrud was completely right. It didn't matter. Dr. Fager won by 3 lengths. Gamely, the great distaffer, finished second. Rising Market was third. And Kissing George, an outstanding stakes runner on the Southern California circuit, ended up 10th in that race. But I'll never forget Benoit telling me that story, and I could just picture him, you know, being so worried to call John Nayrud to tell him he's got to carry 6 pounds more in a stakes race, and Mr. Nayrud going, it won't matter.
Well, and you know, there's a corollary story, and I thought maybe at first, and then I realized we're talking Dr. Fager as opposed to Ta Wee. I mean, there's the story about. About the weight on Ta Wee, which is similar, or I think it was on, with Ta Wee that he said, make it 140.
It was. That's exactly right.
Where they said, you know, I think the fall high weight, and basically, it may have been. I'm just thinking about the conversations I've had, I think Tommy Trotter at that time, probably it's a good chance that Tommy Trotter was the racing secretary, and
I think so, yes,
and said we got to give her, I think 138 maybe, and Nayrud said make it 140. And to prove, I guess, to prove a point, or just, you know, just to you know, set a standard that is difficult to imagine. But That not only that's my memory of it. I'm sure there's somebody. Maybe Harry Rice can burnish that correctly. If I'm off.
Well, she did win that fall highweight with 140, and then she came back in her career finale and won with 142 in the Interbirth.
That's right.
I mean, when you look at what she accomplished, I mean, and think of that broodmare producing both Ta-Wee and Dr. Fager, but because, I mean, Ta-Wee ranks high on my list of top 100 thoroughbreds to have raced in the United States during that century. I mean, she was certainly one of the greatest sprinters of all time. And speaking of great sprinters, we've got the Kona Gold coming up this weekend at Santa Anita, too. And, of course, he's not yet in the Hall of Fame. I'm crossing my fingers that maybe this will be his year because he certainly deserves it. And we'll see if finally we can get but, boy, there's such a seemingly groundswell of so many Hall of Fame voters to not want to put a sprinter into the Hall of Fame. But Dr. Fager is in the Hall of Fame, but Kona Gold belongs in the Hall of Fame as well.
Very much so. Voting actually wrapped up on Friday, the 14th, or maybe Saturday, the 15th. I guess the postmark had to be. So we will hear, when Brian Bouye announced the group that, of horses and humans, that were the finalists. And we discussed it with Jay Privman and with Steve Crist. While I'm in traditionally at Churchill, is the announcement always comes. So we will have those happy conversations. And there's certainly, there's certainly some serious horses. In fact, I was just straightening my desk this morning, and I had that information package that I made sure to put in my briefcase for, when we're in Kentucky and we have that discussion. Speaking of being in Kentucky, John, and I'm glad you made reference to things resuming, racing, picking up again at Santa Anita this weekend. But on the Kentucky front, I want to start these conversations. The regulars are each going to utilize four horses that are part of the Derby field as we know it right now. And we're basically going to get kind of an introduction and get everybody acclimated, looking ahead to the real serious Derby coverage that will begin in earnest on Monday from Churchill Downs. And what we're going to do is kind of go through each of the horses from a running style, from a race record, pedigree. Then we want to establish what the fair odds will be and whether they're a win candidate, an exotic candidate, or an exclusion. And since you're early in the week, you got to cherry pick the list of let's say 20. Right now it's a list of 26. You got to cherry pick your four, John. So I suppose to go through them for you, I'll turn it over, and you can go through and I guess do it in point order, and that would, I guess, start with Forte.
Okay, and let me just say that the four I picked aren't necessarily the four horses that I like the best for the Kentucky Derby. I picked four that I thought would be good for discussion on your show.
Sure.
And my top four right now would be Practical Move, Kings Barnes, Tapitrice, and Angel of Empire with Forte fifth. And when I get to, but now that I'm going to talk about Forte, I'll explain why I don't have him ranked higher than fifth on my top 10 at this time. In terms of Forte's breeding, we'll start with his breeding. He's by Violence, and I'm not totally sold on an offspring of Violence winning the Derby at a mile and a quarter. But I will say it's not nearly as much of a concern to me as it is with Practical Move sire, Practical Joke. But there's kind of a similarity there a little bit in terms of the sire. But Forte's Dam is by Blame, who, of course, won the Mile and a Quarter Breeders' Cup Classic at defeating the great Zenyatta, which was their only loss in 20 career starts. So the pedigree, it's not like, to me, you look at it and say, ah, this is fabulous for a mile and a quarter, but it's good enough. If he doesn't win, to me, it's probably not his pedigree, but I'm a little bit concerned about the violence. As far as his running style, it's to come from off the pace, but he does tend to race in mid-pack early, not far back. But he was far back early in the Florida Derby, but I think that was primarily because of having to break from that post 11 going a mile and an eighth with the short run to the first turn. My main knock on Forte style-wise is he hasn't been first or second a furlong out in both of his last two races. He was fifth a furlong out in the Florida Derby, and he was third a furlong out in the Fountain of Youth. And to me, that doesn't bode well for him being able to be first or second a furlong out in the Kentucky Derby. And being first or second a furlong out in the Kentucky Derby is very important to me, because 56 of the last 60 Kentucky Derby winners were first or second at the eighth pole. Forte does have a number of positives, of course. He's a champion, and he's also trained by Pletcher, who is a two-time Kentucky Derby winner as a trainer. And Forte is one of the few horses that will be going into the Kentucky Derby winner to have recorded a triple-digit buyer. But in addition to my concern about Forte being able to be first or second a furlong out in the Kentucky Derby, a big negative for him, to me, is his declining buyer speed figure pattern. Now, buyers were first published in the Daily Racing Form for the 1992 Kentucky Derby. So during the buyer era going back to 1992, I wondered how many Kentucky Derby winners have had a declining buyer pattern like Forte. And the answer is one. One horse has had his last three races before the Kentucky Derby where they declined going into the Derby, and that horse was Street Sense. And Street Sense, like Forte, was the two-year-old male champ. Street Sense's in his final three starts before the 2007 Kentucky Derby, his buyers were 108, then 102, then 93. And then he jumped up and got a 110 in the Kentucky Derby. But it seems to me that it doesn't look good for Forte to be trying to do something that only one other horse has done in the last 31 years. So, I mean, the exception has been Street Sense. Will Forte also be an exception? And we'll see. Now, can Forte win the Kentucky Derby? Of course he can. I mean, he's going to be the favorite. And I don't think there's any possible way. You talked about fair value or fair odds. I don't see any way he's going to be what I would consider fair odds based on how I see his chances to win the race. As I mentioned, I was in Vegas over the weekend. He was the 5-2 favorite at Circa. He was the 2-1 favorite at Caesars, and he was the 9-5 chalk at the Westgate. And for me, those are just terrible prices in relation to how much of a chance that I believe he actually has to win the race. So I don't see him being worth betting at such a low price. He certainly is a win candidate and an exotics candidate, but he is not a candidate to offer any kind of value in the race.
I don't disagree. All right.
Okay, we move on to Practical Move. And, of course, he's number one on my Kentucky Derby top 10. First, let's look at his pedigree. He's by Practical Joke out of an affiliate, Alex Mayer. Now, as a son of Practical Joke, it's a concern for many. And, look, I say understandably so. I'm included in that as to whether Practical Move has the needed stamina to win going a mile and a quarter. Practical Joke was basically a sprinter miler type, and just last weekend he sired the winner of the Count Fleet Sprint Handicap at 6 furlongs, which was won by Skelly. But on the other hand, Practical Move hasn't been at stud all that long, so I think it's too early to really be dogmatic in terms of his stamina siring ability. And I think you should remember that Practical Joke is by Into Mischief, who has sired a pair of Kentucky Derby winners in Authentic and Mandaloon. So there is stamina even with the Practical Joke aspect of the pedigree. But the big news, the good news, pedigree-wise for practical move, going a mile and a quarter, is his maternal grandsire, Fleet Alex, who had the stamina to win the Belmont Stakes by 7 lengths. Knight made a big bet on a Fleet Alex in the Belmont. One of the main reasons I made that big bet is I didn't think there was any problem whatsoever with a Fleet Alex winning in a mile and a half, especially when he almost fell, when he clipped heels, turning into the stretch in the Preakness and won by, you know, daylight. So I thought he was an absolute cinch in that Belmont. And another reason I thought that a Fleet Alex was a cinch in the Belmont is his broodmare sire was Hoxter. And I called the official Daily Racing Form chart of the 1989 Oak Tree Invitational at Santa Anita that Hoxter not only won, but he ran an absolute freakish race that day. Pat Valenzuela was supposed to come in and ride Hoxter in that race, and he did. It was one of those days he didn't show up. And so Ron McAnally had to find a rider, and he chose Russell Bayes. And it turned out to be one of the most important victories of Bayes' Hall of Fame career. Now, remember, the Oak Tree Invitational was a mile-and-a-half grass race. And Hoxter was 7 lengths in front passing the grandstand the first time. He was 9 in front going into the far turn, and 7 in front at the eighth pole, and he won by 4 lengths and broke the world record. So he was a world record holder at a mile and a half. I would urge your listeners, if you want to see for yourself just how impressive Hoxter was going a mile and a half, go to YouTube and just type in the 1989 Oak Tree Invitational, and you'll hear a kind of a young Trevor Denman calling that race. As far as Practical Boo's running style, it's to race forwardly early, and that could put him in an excellent tactical position early in the Kentucky Derby, which this year doesn't look like it's going to have all that fast of a pace. There's really not all that much early speed in this race, and so the fact that Practical Move is tactical could be a real key for him. He's got other positives, like the fact that he's going to be the only horse in the Kentucky Derby with more than one triple-digit buyer speed figure. He's posted back-to-back 100 buyers. And another thing that I think is a positive for him, he showed in the Santa Anita Derby that he's got heart. He's a fighter. I mean, he won in a battle. I had him singled in the coast-to-coast pick five, and at the 16th pole, I thought he there was no way he was winning that race. I didn't think he was going to run second. And so he dug deep and found a way to win that race. So all in all, Practical Move's running style, his speed figures, his class, his gameness, I think they're all positives for him. And again, the main negative is whether he's going to have the stamina to win in a mile and a quarter. And I do think that that concern is amplified by the fact that he was a length in front at the eighth pole in the Santa Anita Derby, and his lead shrank, and he won by only a nose. I see him as a definite win candidate and a definite exotics candidate. As for an acceptable price, well, for me, anything under 83 to 1 is not acceptable, since I have them at 83 to 1 for $200 in the future wager I made in February. So I won't be betting him in the Kentucky Derby, because there's no way he's going to be anywhere close to 83 to 1. But seriously, I think anywhere like 8 to 1 or higher would be a fair price on Practical Move.
Excellent. Nice job.
So then we'll move on to King's Barns. Now we'll start with his pedigrees by Uncle Mo out of a Tappet mare. And there's plenty of stamina here. Uncle Mo is the sire of last year's Belmont Stakes winner, Modonegal. And Tappet, I think we all know that Tappet's a tremendous source of stamina. He sired 4 winners of the mile and a half Belmont. As far as King's Barnes' running style, it's to race on or near the early lead. He led all the way while getting away with setting a slow pace in the Louisiana Derby. But look, he doesn't have to be in front in order to win. His first two races, he came from off the pace. And I actually think he might be better off having a target to run at early. I think his connections feel that way too. In other words, they'd be just as happy to have him sitting just off the pace in the Kentucky Derby. So that's kind of the trip I'm envisioning for him in the run for the roses. So I think the bottom line is that he should be sitting in a very good spot early. And Remember, 8 of the last 9 Kentucky Derbies have been won by a horse either on the early lead or just off the early lead. And that, I think that's where Kingsbarn's going to find himself. So I consider his running style to be one of his positives. Another positive is the fact that Pletcher's his trainer. And I really think his biggest positive is that he's unbeaten and tested. He's a perfect 3-for-3, and he's going to be the only undefeated horse in the Kentucky Derby. And Justify, people may remember, he was also 3-for-3 going into the Kentucky Derby, which he won. But actually, Kingsbarn's is better off with his 3-for-3 than Justify was. And that's because all of Justify's first 3 races came at the same track, Santa Anita. Kingsbarn's has shown that he could win at 3 different tracks. And what's really impressive about that to me, you know, Tampa Bay is such a quirky track. A lot of horses have gone there and not like that surface. So the fact that he's won at Gulfstream, Tampa, and also Fairgrounds, that shows something on his part to me. So, you know, that's 3 quite different surfaces. How good is Kingsbarn's? You know, since he's undefeated, who knows? You know, maybe he's a superstar. He probably isn't, but at this point, we really don't know until he gets beat. So, to me, that's something. If you like, if you play Kingsbarn's, you have going for you. There's the upside that we just don't know what we're dealing with here, because so far nobody's been able to beat him. Now, his negatives. One of them, of course, is his lack of experience. With only 3 races under his belt, you know, the fewest number of starts, prior starts by a Kentucky Derby winner from 1900 to the present is 3. And only 3 horses have won the Kentucky Derby with only 3 starts under their belt. The tremendous regret in 1915, the filly, Big Brown in 2008 and Justify in 2018. So that there's no getting around it. That's a big negative for Kingsbarn. Another negative is the fact that Flavian Pratt's opted to ride Angel of Empire instead of Kingsbarn. Now, Pratt won the Louisiana Derby on Kingsbarn and the Arkansas Derby on Angel of Empire. You know, and since I like Kingsbarn a lot in the Kentucky Derby, you know, I would certainly prefer to see that Pratt was sticking with Kingsbarn. But do jockeys always make the right decision when they have to pick between 2 horses? And we all know, no, they don't always make the right decision. For instance, you go back to 1995, and Mike Smith decided to ride Talkin' Man in the Kentucky Derby. That was a perfectly understandable decision because Talkin' Man went off as the 4-to-1 second favorite, while Thunder Gulch was a big long shot. And Smith's decision to go with Talkin' Man left the mount open on Thunder Gulch. Gary Stevens picked up that mount and won the Kentucky Derby at 24-to-1, while Talkin' Man finished 12th. So there's a prime example of where a jockey had his choice between the 2, and the one he picked did not win, and the one he didn't pick ended up winning the Kentucky Derby. Still another negative for Kingsbarn, and this one is a real biggie to me, is that he didn't race as a 2-year-old. And as practically everybody knows, only 2 horses have ever won the Kentucky Derby without running as a 2-year-old, Apollo in 1882 and Justify in 2018. So, you know, it's still that, and it's interesting to me that with Justify, that was a huge deal, and all the talk about the Apollo jinx or the Apollo hex. And we're not hearing hardly anything about that talk for Kingsbarn, but it's still important. I mean, just because Justify did it, you know, it's still, I would prefer to have a horse with some, you know, a race as a 2-year-old. It sure. Just, you know, it just makes sense. Now, to me, the question is Kingsbarn such an exceptional talent that he can overcome his negatives and win the Derby? And I do think it's possible. I think he might be that kind of talent. So I do consider him to be a serious win candidate. But the way I look at Kingsbarn is I think he's a win or finish off the board type. In other words, he's really something special, and he wins the Kentucky Derby, and he's 4-for-4. But if he's not that kind of talent, if he's not that exceptional with the negatives that he has, I think he'll be off the board. So he's not the kind of horse to me that I would be playing underneath in the exotics. What would be an acceptable price for him? I think 12-1 or higher would be good for him. So, I think he's going to be in that ballpark. So, again, like in Vegas, he's 10-1, 12-1. And I think that's a fair price. I mean, if he went under like 10-1, I think that would be a terrible price. And anything from like 12 or up, I think would be good.
All right, and your fourth, and this will be as intriguing a candidate as there's been in of European or, you know, Asian Australian racing invaders, Derma Sotogaki, and Continuar as well, but particularly the UAE Derby winner. This is going to be one of the most, you know, vexing questions of this race.
Well, I'm glad you framed it that way, because that's exactly why I picked him to talk about. So let's start with his pedigree. His sire is Mind Your Biscuits, who's familiar with a lot of people, and he was known pretty much as a sprinter miler, like Practical Joke. But one thing about Derma Sotogaki, you know, at least he's already demonstrated that he's got the stamina to win not only the UAE Derby at about a mile and 3/16, farther than a mile and an eighth, but he did so by 5.5 lengths. So he won with such authority going a mile and 3/16. It's not like you're saying, wow, I can't picture him getting a mile and a quarter. And, of course, one of the sources of stamina in his pedigree, not surprisingly, you'll find the name of Sunday Silence on the bottom side of his pedigree. And Sunday Silence, to me, the biggest mistake that American breeding ever made, letting him go to Japan, where he became such a phenomenal sire. Derma Sotogaki's dam is a granddaughter of Sunday Silence. And by the way, Mandarin Harrell's dam is also a granddaughter of Sunday Silence. And when you look at those top horses in Japan, almost without fail, you're going to see Sunday Silence in that pedigree. And, of course, we all remember Sunday Silence and Easy Goer, that fabulous rivalry in 1989. As far as running style is concerned, Derma Sotogaki won the UAE Derby in front-running fashion, but like Kings Barnes, he's not a need-the-early-lead type. I don't think the Connections necessarily wanted him on the lead in the UAE Derby, but he broke well, and he found himself there. So I think, like Kings Barnes, Derma Sotogaki's running style is a plus. It's a positive for him, and that he could really get a trip similar to eight of the last nine Kentucky Derby winners. Another big positive for him is Japan's power on the world stage in recent years. For instance, Japanese runners finished 1, 2, 3, 4 in the recent UAE Derby. But, I mean, they not only ran 1, 2, 3, 4, they dominated as 1, 2, 3, 4. Mandarin Harrell, who had been running exclusively at a B track in Japan, came within a nose of winning the Santa Anita Derby. And, you know, people remember a couple of years ago, Japanese horses won 2 Breeders' Cup races. I mean, they're just making their presence felt all over the globe. You know, the big turning point for Japan was when they imported Sunday Silence. But then they've been so active at that November breeding sale in Kentucky and snapping up those broodmares. And, I mean, they've done just such an admirable job of improving their breeding and improving their racing. And another aspect of Japan is when I was there in the early 1990s, when the Frank Miramonte's favorite horse, Golden Pheasant, won the Japan Cup under Gary Stevens, at that time, there wasn't that much dirt racing in Japan. And what dirt racing there was, it was kind of a lower level. And that's another thing that they've improved dramatically on through the years, is they added a Japan dirt race to the Japan Cup race in the turf, and they've really improved dramatically again with their breeding for dirt and also their racing on dirt. In terms of negatives, no doubt the biggest negative for Dermot Sotogaki is the dismal record in the Kentucky Derby by UAE Derby runners. UAE starters are a combined 0-18 in the Kentucky Derby, with the best finish being 5th by Master of Hounds in 2011. Not Master of Foxhounds, that's running at Santa Anita these days, but Master of Hounds in 2011. And the best finish by a UAE Derby winner in the Kentucky Derby came when China Visit finished 6th in the Run for the Roses all the way back in 2000. Excuse me. So, you know, that dismal record is something that it makes it hard to swallow. You know, I bet $1,000 on Thunder of Snow in the Kentucky Derby. He was 16-1, and I really thought he had a good chance to win that day, and he turned into a bronking bucko. Bronco leaving the gate, and he would go on to win 2 Dubai World Cups. So I don't really feel I was way off base betting that horse that day. And, you know, you figure one of these years Japan is going to do it, but you have to look at that record. You remember Mendelsohn won the UAE Derby by a block and came over and broke bad in the Kentucky Derby and finished last. So, you know, you just can't get around that poor record by the UAE Derby runners in the Kentucky Derby. Now, despite that, I do view Dermot Sotogaki as a bona fide Kentucky Derby win candidate. Randy Moss has pointed out that they don't have an official buyer figure for his UAE Derby, but it would have been a triple digit. So he's one of the few horses that would have a triple digit buyer in the Kentucky Derby, and it would be a bigger buyer than even the winner of the Dubai World Cup. So that's pretty strong stuff. And I know that Randy really likes Dermot Sotogaki in the Kentucky Derby. And look, I can understand anybody who likes him. I mean, he's a very talented horse. He's got the right running style. And the way Japan has been doing so well, I mean, it's not hard to see him posing for pictures and posing with the garland of roses after the race. What's an acceptable price? I'd say 12-1 or higher, but I don't think he's going to be that. He was 6-1 in the Daily Racing Form Derby Watch last week, and I think he's, you know, in the odds I gave you, I made him 8-1, and yet there might be some hope that we might be thinking he's going to get a lot of play, and then he doesn't. And the reason I say that, again, being in Vegas over the weekend, his odds over there were 10-1 to 12-1. And the thing that counts about Vegas and those odds, people are actually betting into those odds. For instance, Derby Watch, that's just a person's opinion of the odds. Whereas in Vegas, those odds are live. In other words, they're going to lower those odds if some guy comes in and hammers Dermot Sotogaki. So the fact that he's not under 10-1 in Vegas at this time could indicate that we might be a little off base here thinking just how much he's going to get. But I certainly could see him being a wise guy horse, and he's going to get a lot of hype and a lot of attention in the media. And look, but he ran such a good race last time. He's got to be taken very seriously. So that's my look at Dermot Sotogaki.
Dermot Sotogaki, Kings Barnes, Practical Move, and Forte. John, this was terrific. Great start. A lot of the regulars are each going to offer up these insights and analysis of what looks to be our Derby field as of now, and still plenty of time to, you know, work other horses in. Jace's Road, Skinner, Cyclone Mischief, Major Dude, Mandarin Hero, and King Russell are the six that are waiting and watching for anybody to drop out. This was great. John, I will talk to you next week from Churchill Downs.
Very good, Steve. Take care.
John White, everybody, and post time, John, on your Twitter. Let's do this. We'll take our break now and come back. We've got Jim Watkins. We're going to go to FanDuel Racing, the racetrack formerly known as Fairmont Park. We'll catch up with Jim. We are going to have Popo pop in. Probably around 11:45. I want him to talk about AmWager's betting tools. the way we framed it yesterday, you heard Joe Applebaum from NYFA, and Joe essentially, you know, offering the concept that we have to utilize the, you know, the tools, that modern tools, to help players gain some degree of balance and equilibrium with the groups. I mean, I think it's a near impossible, you know, piece of ground to cover and to make up, given the edges that they've got. But there are some tools that, you know, that can help, and at least, you know, give players, you know, a better understanding of the pool that they're betting into, and, you know, what their potential return might be, as opposed to getting surprised, you know, when the, you know, after the bell rings and seeing numbers, you know, drop. You know, plus what's available in terms of, you know, being able to stack wagers and, you know, get the amount of bets in that. I don't know how we compete as individuals, but we're gonna survey. We'll survey the platforms and let them tell us, and we'll also reach out and try to find some of, you know, there's plenty of people that are working on innovations. I mean, Scotty McKeever, with what Scotty's doing. Of course, Scotty, a big part of the Ollie Reeder article in Financial Times 2 weeks.